Welcome, friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today, broadcasting from the Eastern Plains of Colorado. Son Daniel in studio with us today, and we're raising our five children out here on the Eastern Plains of Colorado, and doing it during the demise of Western civilization, the breakdown of the American Republic. Friends, we're losing faith, family, and freedom, and these things, of course, being great values that we have enjoyed over centuries of this nation's history. This nation probably has enjoyed the most freedom and the most self-consistent biblical worldview in its social systems of any nation around the world in any time in human history. It's hard to find another nation that had such good roots. And friends, we have a worldview that continues to represent a Christian way of thinking in many, many ways. There's still some 45% of Americans that believe that they were created 6,000 years ago. Now, find another nation around the world where we can say that of the people. You're not going to find it. Now, of course, the Europeans mock at us, and the Soviets or the Russians and the Chinese would mock at us, that we still retain something of a Christian worldview in this country. That's right, some 45% of people still hanging on to the notion that there is a God, and he created them some 6,000 years ago. And the reason for that, the reason why this nation still has something of a worldview, and certainly the largest creation movement, the largest Christian worldview movement in Summit Ministries and other great ministries around the U.S., the reason we have somewhat of a semblance of a biblical worldview in this country and not in Australia and Japan and Russia and England, the reason why it's here and the reason we have 2.5 million Christian home educators here in America is because we have great roots, fantastic roots that go back hundreds and hundreds of years. It's amazing, friends, what a self-consciously consistent Christian founding will do for a nation over hundreds of years. Now, this last weekend, I had the opportunity to interact with an immigrant people that have come to America, and this is the largest Christian immigration to America since the founding of this nation in the 1600s with the Pilgrims and Puritans coming over here. Friends, this is the largest Christian migration into America, happened over the last 20 years, and it is the Slavics. The Slavics, terribly persecuted in countries like Russia, Ukraine, etc., parts of the Soviet Union through the 1970s, 1980s, and eventually migrated here in the 1990s. These people were terribly persecuted over 80, 90 years under the Soviets, and they finally made it out of the Soviet Union into America and have migrated here over the last 20 to 30 years. They're, of course, very, very open to what we have to give them ourselves as the Christian home education movement and as those who believe in home discipleship, because they're losing their children's hearts and they're quickly seeing what happened to the Pilgrims when they moved into Holland for a period of time. According to John Winthrop, the reason why, or John Robinson, some of the other guys, the reason why they brought the folks over to America is because they saw the influences of the Dutch community and a secularistic worldview upon the children, and they wanted to retain something of a biblical worldview in their children up to multiple generations. So we had Pilgrims and Puritans that came over here in the 1620s and 1630s, and this is somewhat like what we're seeing with the Slavic migration. So I was amazed at the opportunities that we had to speak to radio stations, TV stations. We were talking to pastors of a 6,000-member church in Sacramento over the weekend. We'll have more opportunities here in upcoming weekends to continue to reach out to these people who really want to retain something of the faith. They want to see some strong family values and some strong family relationships maintained and family discipleship brought in so that they don't lose their kids to the world, which is happening wholesale among Christians here in this country, and they're aware of that. They're starting to see it happening with their own children, their open ears to the kind of vision that you get on this radio program each day. But friends, we want to go back into history today, and we want to look at the Pilgrims and Puritans, because these are our roots. Now, granted, we've come a long way from these roots. They had Trinitarian oaths in order to be part of state legislatures up through the 1600s and 1700s in this country. That's right. In fact, they had capital punishment for gross sexual sins. I mean, really, really gross. I mean, we're talking about sexual crimes. They would apply capital punishment for first-degree murder on a consistent basis. And according to Cotton Mather's History of the Christian Nation of America, what we find is that they would preach messages to the convicts before they went ahead with the executions. If a guy committed murder, he was committed to capital punishment. But before that, the 2 to 3 days before, they would preach multiple messages to this man, calling for him to repent of his sins and seek faith in Jesus Christ alone for his salvation. These kind of messages were preached. You read the founding documents. You read these founding histories written by guys like Cotton Mather, and what you find are things that you don't find in America. Hey, in Colorado, they don't preach messages, Christian messages from the Bible, calling men to repentance before they hang them. The state of Colorado. No, actually what happens in Colorado is they don't hang them anymore. They don't do execution. The last capital punishment trial, the thing was thrown out in this state some 10 years ago by the Supreme Court of Colorado. Why? Because somebody mentioned a Bible verse in the jury negotiations. Somebody happened to mention Genesis 9:6, and so of course the secularists who run this state tossed that out. We don't have a biblical worldview in this state, in this country anymore. And as you know, SB 200, a bill signed by the governor in 2007, outlawed the Bible in the state. So we're up for 1 year in prison if we distribute the Bible or any other literature that could be perceived as offensive to homosexuals. And oh, by the way, we right now are seeing a civil unions bill for homosexuals passed through the Senate here in the state last week and now through the House. And that could very well happen. And the governor may sign that bill as well. So homosexual marriage coming like a freight train in this state, as it has in other states. Friends, we are a long, long, long way from our roots. A long way from our roots. Why? Why? Because the Christian church did not see that the law of God ought to be applied in politics. Because we turned into a bunch of pietists. We separated the Bible from life, and then we had this watered-down gospel that never saved anybody, and we wound up separating from our roots in a serious way over a long period of time. And by the way, the seminaries and the churches are still doing everything they can to reduce any kind of Christian influence, any kind of biblical influence in civil politics today. And we're talking about conservative churches as well. They're afraid to talk about the application of God's ethical standards to all areas of life, including the civil magistrate. That's pretty much what happens in 95-98% of the churches across this country. There are still a few people who have the vision that started this nation, and of course we have wonderful Christian roots, and God has blessed this nation unlike any other nation over 400 years, because I believe we had some very consistent roots at the beginning. But now we're way, way away from that, and we're breaking down economically, socially, and of course spiritually. Well, in just a moment we're going to talk about our roots with somebody who spent his entire doctoral thesis on this issue. Dr. Brian Rapp Epshire. Dr. Brian Epshire looked at the founding of this nation and the influence of the Puritans over centuries. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Brian Epshire. You're not going to want to miss this message unless you're not an American and you're not interested in the roots of this nation. Be back in just a moment.
I have always felt that doubt was the beginning of wisdom, and the fear of God was the end of wisdom.
Clarence Darrow.
The only true wisdom is knowing that you know nothing.
Socrates.
Belief is the death of intelligence.
Robert Anton Wilson.
If thou trusteth to the book called the Scriptures, thou trusteth to the rotten staff of fables and falsehood.
Thomas Paine.
Faith is believing what you know ain't so.
Mark Twain.
Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered.
God.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight.
God.
The fool believes his own ideas to be wisdom, but those who fear God and search for understanding find true wisdom. To lead your family in the pursuit of godliness, pick up a copy of Proverbs Study Guide at generationswithvision.com.
And welcome back to the Generations Radio Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today, talking about the roots of this nation and the effect those roots have on centuries generations of human life, and we hope this edition of the broadcast will give you some vision for your own generations and what God can do in this generation. With me is Dr. Brian Abshire, who has spoken at many, many Worldview conferences, will be speaking at the West Coast Worldview Conference, and we'll give you a little bit more information on that in just a moment. But he has studied the sociological effects of New England Puritanism on the development of American cultural values, and that pretty much made up his doctoral thesis. But most importantly, Brian and his wife have raised 6 children who love God and are out there serving Him. Brian, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, this topic is very important. I'm so glad somebody did a doctoral thesis on this, because these are our roots, Brian. The Puritans, the Pilgrims, they formed the nation in New England 400 years ago.
You're absolutely right. In fact, you can actually look at American history, and from one perspective, and it's a very valid one, as basically being a Puritan foundation at the very beginning that influenced the entire colonial period from 1630 onward. And everything else that's happened in our country is basically a reaction to the Puritans. So whether you love them or hate them, they basically gave us our distinctive stamp, if you will, of what it means to be an American. And you can only appreciate that really if you've spent some time in other European nations, soaked up their culture, their language, their values, how they work, how they resolve relationships, how they see the world, how they treat issues such as, you know, sexuality, work, time use, and then compare with Americans, and they often laugh at us, and they often, you know, ridicule us, and they don't like us because of our success and prosperity, and they Europeans often rejoice whenever they see some failure. But all of the things that make us distinctly American, as opposed to any other European or offshoot of European civilization, can really be traced all the way back to the Puritans and the tremendous influence they had. And what's significant is that the Puritans only really were dominant in our culture for about, well, less than 100 years, from about 1630 right down to about maybe 1680, 1690 or so.
Right. By the time you get to Increase Mather and Cotton Mather, you're working your way out. I think somebody said that Increase Mather was the last American Puritan. That was one of the books I read recently on that. But let's talk a little bit about them. I mean, there's been so many stereotypes, and somebody said the winners write the history books, meaning that, once you've overcome the influence of the Puritans as best as you can in your own mind, you're going to reinterpret them and redefine them. So you've got these stereotypes about the Puritans. They were against sex. They never laughed. They wore drab, unfashionable clothes. They were opposed to sports or recreation. They were hostile to the arts. They denigrated reason. They were repelled by the human body or the physical world. They were over-strict. I mean, these are some of the things that we read in the history, but as they define the Puritans. What's wrong with this?
Everything is wrong with it. In fact, that picture is probably closer to some aspects of Victorian culture in the latter decades of the 19th century than it was of Puritan culture in the 17th. The Puritans had a very consistent, comprehensive worldview. They wanted to order every area of life according to what they understood at the time to be biblical principles. However, if you read the letters, the journals, and even, you know, read between the lines of some of the sermons of the era, you get a completely different picture. The Puritans actually liked a body joke. They talked about sex, and especially in very passionate terms. Of course, the language is different and the culture is different, but it was only between a man and his wife. It wasn't, you know, rampant sexuality. They looked down on fornication. They were, of course, very much opposed to adultery, because those things destroyed the social order. But in terms of within the context that God had given them, they were very much, a very lusty people. And in terms of the whole thing about, you know, wearing the dark clothing and that kind of stuff, it had more to do with their idea that God had called a man to his position. They were far more concerned about, for example, poor people trying to ape their betters and therefore spending their precious resources on buying lace cuffs, for example, to make themselves look more affluent than they were. Now, we might have a legitimate kind of criticism of whether or not their view of society was always necessarily fully biblical, but their idea that God called a man to a position in life, that he should be content with that position and seek to fulfill his calling under God with love and humility and duty and diligence, that was really what ordered their culture, and that's really where some of the modern stereotypes come from.
Now, of course, the Puritans came from England, and they were the serious ones when it came to the Reformation and the Bible. They were into the these guys were serious. They were committed to the scriptures. Is it fair to say that these were the best of the Reformation?
Well, we want to be careful on there because, you see, I'm a Presbyterian, so, of course, you know, I'm...
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm talking about the English Reformation. Okay, the Scottish did something, but the English Reformation was a little different than the Scottish Reformation.
There's a very complex problem that has resulted because the Church of England was an established religion, and the Puritans originally were Reformed believers, believers who had embraced the Reformation and were trying to bring about changes inside the Church of England to purify the religion, which is where they got that ridicule. You know, that's a term that was always used to be derogatory and condescending and kind of like the British calling us Yankees, you know, during our War of Independence. It was a term we embrace today with you know, kind of a, you know, savoir faire, but in those days it was supposed to be a put down. Well, the Puritans, there was a significant number of them who could see what was happening on the horizon, that they could see that Britain was falling into chaos, that war was going to come, that there was going to be no compromise between the independents, those inside the Puritan Church, the Presbyterians, as well as the Anglicans, as well as Roman Catholic influence. And so there was a significant number of them, especially from East Anglia, who could see the clouds gathering on the horizon, and they wanted, on one hand, to preserve and protect their families, and were willing to give up businesses, family, lands that had been in their families for generations, and strike out to the new world. But they also saw the futility of trying to fight within the present system, that it was going to go back and forth. And they thought, give us a place, a wilderness, if you will, where we can go and we can build a biblical commonwealth on the ground up. We won't have to deal with all of the problems, all of the politics, all the factions. And in that sense, they were basically a stream of Christians, which I don't think any other group in the history of Western civilization quite compares with them.
Yeah.
Because all the things that they said were going to happen did happen. And you can see what happened with the English Civil War that started within 10 years of the migration to New England. You can see what happened with Cromwell. You can see what happened after that, you know, when Cromwell died and England fell back into Anglicanism and compromise and all that sort of thing. And so they were willing to put everything on their line, to give up everything with the idea of building the kind of church and the kind of social order that they felt God commanded in his word. And that makes them a remarkable group of people.
It was quite an experiment in all of human history, and I think we are the result of it. We have much to be thankful for. As you look at their sermons, you said it's important to read their writings, read their sermons, read the diaries. What do you discover? What do they teach? What do they listen to in these Sabbath morning sermons?
Well, you always find that the absolute sovereignty of God is first and foremost, that they believed with every fiber of their being that there is a God in the heavens who rules every area of life, that all the vicissitudes of, say, 17th century living where, you know, women died in childbirth and a lot of children died of diseases they didn't understand in those days. There was no antibiotics and there was no modern surgery, and we're just on the very cusp of the modern scientific movement where we're beginning to have a greater, richer understanding of the world. They believed firmly and fully in a providential God who was governing every area of life, and that his word was completely sufficient to reveal his will. Now, what I think is significant about this is that the mindset that they developed in order to understand this revelation of God, the, you know, inductive method of doing Bible study and being able to analyze the scriptures and not letting, you know, allegorical interpretations and fanciful interpretations, but rather that God's word itself was the clearest expression of his will, and that to glorify him meant to understand that. That became the foundation for rationalism, for basically the Enlightenment, and for the scientific method. That was all built and based upon the idea that there's a sovereign God who rules creation. He's the God of order, not of chaos. He has given us a revelation in his word. His word needs to be understood to glorify him, and therefore we must train our minds to think rationally, not to do as the old Roman church did and read way too much into Scripture, not make up our own rules and regulations, but rather to submit ourselves to the authority of His written word.
Brian, I want to talk about all these various areas of life if we have time. I want to get into politics. I want to talk education, family. But what do you think is the most influential contribution on the part of the Puritans in those early generations that affected multiple generations to come?
Honestly, one of the predominant sociological factors, okay, now I'm stepping back now as a pastor and looking at it more as a sociologist. One of the dominant things they did was the value of work. Because there was a sovereign God in the heavens who created all things for His own glory, that means each individual person has a place. And so the Puritans were one of the, I don't want to say the first, but they were certainly one of the most ones who emphasized this, that every man, no matter what his skills, no matter what his position in society, his work is valuable. That the work of the pastor or the preacher or the physician or the scientist or the educator is no more important inherently than the work of a man who tills his field, who digs a ditch, who pumps out your septic tank. That all work glorifies God, that there is value in that work. And so within one generation, for example, within 10 years, the Puritans went into England, which is if you ever lived there, I'm from Maine, I grew up in New England. It's a harsh, cold, nasty place with a very short growing season. The soil is horrible. I mean, one of the stories we were taught as a kid is about Squanto, who taught the pilgrims, how to plant a seed of corn in the ground and put a fish on top of it, because the soil is so poor of nutrients that it needs the flesh of the fish in order to give it enough energy and that fertilizer in order to grow. And so, but they went from within 10 years from literally carving out something out of this harsh, nasty environment. They were self-sufficient in food production and were able to export food back to Europe. Now, take this as a comparison to Virginia, and Virginia is a lush, warm, mild climate with great soil, and it was designed almost by God for agriculture. And they didn't become self-sufficient in food production. They had to import food from England and from New England for like 70 years.
Wow. Incredible.
The difference between the two is this attitude of work.
Another difference, it seems to me, is the South went to slavery and developed these large plantations and brought slaves to do the work. But further north, they relied more on family economies. And those families rolled up their sleeves and made it happen, baby.
Exactly. Well, compare what happened to the Plymouth Colony, which were not Puritans. They were pilgrims, and there was a slightly different offshoot of them. When they first came to Massachusetts, they attempted to build some sort of a utopian Christian socialist kind of situation. And they basically starved, and they almost died. They almost got wiped out until they finally said, no, let each man have his own plot of land. Let each man work it. The Puritans were a little wiser than that, and they understood that family was the foundation of society. That's very much a part of it. That family was the basic bedrock of everything else in the culture. And so the Puritans saw their families much different than we do today. They would consider family second cousins, third cousins. They would consider when they married into a family that family now has the same obligations and duties that their own blood family would have. And so it was a very tightly interconnected group of individuals that worked together, and I think you're absolutely right. But what made that work was not just their love for the family, but the idea that God has a calling on my labor, that I worship Him through my work, and that whatever I do to the glory of God. And I guess that's really the fundamental thing about the Puritans that permeates every aspect of their culture. It's the glory of God that they were committed to.
Yeah. Talk a little bit to the family discipleship. That's a huge emphasis on our program, as you well know. What did the Puritans do with family worship and training their children to take on the faith and carry it on for another generation?
Well, the Puritans believed implicitly and worked it out in their own family that family worship was a fundamental duty of the head of the household. That if he did not do that, he was subject to discipline in the church. He could be removed from the sacraments. He could be excommunicated if he neglected his duties to lead the family in worship. He was also responsible for making sure that his children could read, and therefore literacy was extremely high in Puritan families, almost universal, like something like 99%, because the children would have a duty as they grew older to be able to read the scriptures and the right of interpretation. That was something that was always maintained. And so therefore they were both literate as well as being godly. And so the Sabbath was kept to be holy, and it might be considered pretty difficult by modern standards. With, I think Gary North once called it the marathon view of the Sabbath, where they would go to church for 6 or 8 hours at a time. And I think most of us would suspect that maybe that could have been tweaked a little bit in terms of their understanding and application of the Sabbath. But they kept the Lord's Day holy, and they performed their duties to lead the family in family worship, to teach their children how to read and how to interpret the scriptures for themselves. And as a consequence, a lot of homeschooling, I mean, we homeschooling we think is being a radical new idea that generated somewhere back in the 70s or 80s. But in fact, many Puritans did it because they couldn't afford the extra, cost associated with hiring a tutor for it. But if you were literate yourself, you could teach your children. And, in those days, basically, it was, a version of the Bible that was often the only textbook. Printing was hard and difficult to come by. Books had to come from England on ships, so it was very expensive. So the Bible became the textbook by which children learned to read. And therefore, they soaked up biblical imagery. They soaked up biblical values from a very, very young age. And it was almost like the era in which they breathed.
Yeah.
So it affected every area of their life, every area of their life.
Which is precisely the vision we're trying to communicate on this program for families that listen. Let's talk about politics for just a moment. We don't have a lot of time, and I realize this is probably an hour discussion, but a little bit on the politics. I know it started with John Cotton's Moses' Judicials and other things at the very beginning. Kind of trace it through the first generation or two.
Well, I've got like about 150 pages of this in my doctoral dissertation. Okay, but let me just put it this way. Because they believed that God ordered every area of life, they saw that the civil magistrate was responsible to God. He was just as much a minister of God as the preacher in the local church. The difference was that the civil magistrate had a ministry of justice, where the minister of the gospel had a ministry of grace, of proclaiming the crown rights of King Jesus. And so therefore they thought that the church as a whole needed to instruct the civil magistrate how to fulfill his duties under God. And so Moses' Judicials was an important part of trying to show, okay, this is how the civil order, if you want to obey God, if you want to please God as a civil magistrate, these other kinds of laws that you should pass. This is how you should deal with theft. This is how you should deal with, murder. This is how you should set up the courts and that kind of stuff. And essentially, all of these things that happened in the first couple of generations, they basically became so much a part of American culture that later on, 100 years later, when we were looking at developing our own institutions, all of their values and all of their beliefs were basically secularized by the humanists and were then incorporated into our Constitution. The idea of separation of powers, of representative government, there was a law behind the Constitution, that we're a nation of laws, not of men. All these things that distinguish us from all the European nations can clearly and directly be traced back to what was going on there. Now, civil codes changed because there was some theology, and if we had time, we could talk about what happened in the theology that undermined it. But basically, all of the things like the social idea of the social compact is a direct ripoff of the Puritan doctrine of the covenant.
Yeah.
And so these laws were there. And remember that we have laws on the books, and in fact, in some places to this day, there are still laws on the books, even though they're not enforced, that are directly stem from the Puritan influence. For example, what shops can be open on Sunday and what activities can be allowed. That's a remnant of what the Puritans did 400 years ago.
It's incredible. Well, we only have a few minutes left, Brian, but granted, I mean, there's some amazing things about this historical record. Number one is what you just said, how these laws, these work ethics, these social systems have affected us over hundreds and hundreds of years. This is just a handful of people, and yet they've affected 350 million people. This is mind-blowing that our roots are that important. But on the other hand, it's also, I think, equally mind-blowing that we have jettisoned this history. We have jettisoned these values, and the Christian church, it seems to me, has led the pack in abandoning our roots. I mean, is that right or wrong here?
I think you're spot on. And I think the key thing is that we turned inward rather than outward. And basically what happened in the 18th century and after is that Christians started becoming more concerned with the inner aspects of their faith rather than thinking about how the gospel applied to every area of life. Now, I'm going to be very cynical for a moment. I know we're out of time. But the problem is that the Puritans were so right on certain ethical and moral issues. And men, by nature, by the influence of sin, resist it. They don't want to obey God. And so by turning the faith subtly inward, so they focused on the inner thing, and the technical term for this is called pietism, which was a 18th and 19th century development, they basically became more concerned about their experience of God rather than obedience to God. And once that transformation had happened, modern-day Christianity has basically said, well, each man can serve God in his own way. Each man can do what is right in his own eyes. You know, it's all important that you have, that you love God, that you feel strongly about Him, that you have a passionate religious worship service, that you get close to a transcendental experience of the Almighty, as opposed to saying, you know what, God tells you how to live your life. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church. Wives, respect your husbands. Parents, bring your children up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. Children, honor your father and mother that it may be well with you. Christian, love one another, forgive one another. You know, in other words, we internalize the faith, if in one particular sense, but we stop thinking about how it actually applied outside of our own inner feelings about God. And that was a very subtle attack by the enemy, and it managed to destroy the Christian foundations of our nation, so that when the humanists and the pagans and the evolutionists came up, we had no answer for them.
Yeah, they filled that vacuum.
Yeah. And, I mean, again, if we had time, you know, the whole 19th century is a litany of Christians withdrawing from battlefield after battlefield after battlefield, from science, from culture, from just bowing down to the enemy. Even the great leaders at places like Princeton, when it was the shining beacon of Christian scholarship in the 19th century, they basically adopted Darwinism and evolutionary thought, and they weren't willing to make a stand on what the Bible actually said. They were ceding too much ground to the enemy, as opposed to saying, no, if it's God's word, it's true. And that, by the way, is why six-day creation, I think, is such a fundamentally important battle that Christians must stand on. We've given it to the humanists.
I have to tell you, I think 1960 was a key year when Christians returned to the battlefield. When Henry Morris and John T. Whitcomb's book, Genesis Flood, was published by PNR, that was the turnaround. After that, man, we were back in the worldview battle. We got the Christian home education movement, the Christian school movement. We've got the worldview movements. We had everything started to come. And now, man, we are battling big time for whatever ground we can regain during the breakdown of Christianity and Western civilization, which is what we're confronting right now. That's what makes this life that we live, this generation we're living in, so exciting. I think we're drawing on our roots, but we're also engaging a new battle for a biblical worldview, an explicitly biblical worldview as applied to every area of life. And we're clean out of time, but I want to invite folks down to the West Coast Christian Worldview Conference in California on June 27th to July 1st. And Dr. Brian Abshire will be there to talk about this important history and what we can do to bring ourselves, our families, our people back into this battle. And I truly believe this is the battle of the centuries that we're waging right now on this radio program and in these conferences. Again, that West Coast Worldview Conference is June 27th to July 1st. Dr. Brian Abshire, as well as myself, will be at that conference. For more information, here's a website, WCWC.WS. That's WCWC.WS. That's the website for the West Coast Christian Worldview Conference. Well, we're clean out of time, Brian. It's been great talking, but we've got to complete this thing in June.
Yeah, okay, brother. We'll have a good time, and we're hoping that a lot of people will be able to show up and be able to see the glory of God at work.
Amen. That's WCWC.WS for that website for the Christian Worldview Conference in California. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wonderful stuff today from Dr. Brian Abshire. Friends, as we wrap up this interview, let me encourage you to grab a copy of my book, The Second Mayflower. I talk about this vision. I truly believe that the first Mayflower may give birth to a second. And it seems to me that there is rising in the hearts of many across this nation the vision that really was there at the beginning with the Puritans and Pilgrims who founded this nation many years ago. So, friends, if you're interested in the vision of what founded this nation, if you're interested in your roots, then grab a copy of my book, The Second Mayflower, and hopefully it will inspire you, inspire your children with something of a vision for future generations. By the way, we also have this now on audio set, an MP3 and CD set available at kevinswanson.com. So if you're not the kind of guy who likes to read the book, if you want to get it by audio, it's entirely there in audio, read by our friend Carl Bob, a very, very good compilation of my book, The Second Mayflower, available again at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson, and I want to invite you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.